crowded, smelly bus, trying to keep people from stepping on my ingrown toenail and trying not to think of terrible things, I noticed trouble brewing just across from me. One man had decided he didn't like the way another man was looking at him. Didn't like it at all. It's hard to know where to look when you're wedged in place on a crowded bus. The wedged-in man argued that he hadn't done anything wrong, which he hadn't. He inched toward the exit as though he meant to get himself out of a potentially bad situation. Then he turned and edged back into the argument. Maybe his own pride was involved. Why the hell should he be the one to run away? This time, the other guy decided that it was his girlfriend sitting next to him who was being looked at inappropriately. He attacked. The fight was short and bloody. The rest of us, the other passengers, ducked and yelled and tried to avoid being hit. In the end, the attacker and his girlfriend pushed their way off the bus, fearful that the driver would call the police, and the guy with the pride sagged, dazed, and bloody, looking around as though he wasn't sure what had happened. I sat where I was, more depressed than ever, hating the whole hopeless, stupid business, and wondering whether the human species would ever grow up enough to learn to communicate without using fists of one kind or another. And the first line of a possible story came to me. There was trouble aboard the Washington Boulevard bus. Crossover. At work that day, they put her to soldering J9 connectors into a harness, and they expected her to do twice as many as everyone else. She did, of course, but her only reward was resentment from the slower girls down the line because she was making them look bad. At lunch, a couple of them came to her solitary corner table and told her to ease off. That was how it was. If she did good work, other employees resented her and her lead man ignored her. If her work fell off, other employees ignored her and her lead man wrote bad attitude on her work review. She hadn't had a raise in 2 years. She would have quit long ago had she not been afraid to start all over again at a new place where the people might be even worse. Through the afternoon, all she wanted was 2 or 3 aspirins and sleep. She had not had a headache for 3 months, and this one scared her. As usual, though, she managed to finish the day. When she got off, she even felt hungry enough to make a side trip to the store for a can of something for dinner. It was her headache that drove her to make the shorter trip to the liquor store instead of going to the grocery store. It was her headache. The liquor store was on a corner only 2 blocks from where she worked. It was across from a pool hall and a bar, and near a cheap hotel. That made it a gathering place for certain kinds of people. There was a crowd on the corner when she got there. Besides the usual drunks and prostitutes, there was a group of teenage boys who were bored enough not to ignore her. For a moment, they whispered to each other, laughing. Then, as she passed them, the calls began. "Hey, Jeffrey, there go your old woman. Lady, you sure shouldn't have let that car run over your face. Hey, lady, this boy said he'd go for you." A wino sidled up to her. "Come on, baby, let's you and me go up to my room." She jerked herself out of the alcoholic cloud that surrounded him and went into the store. The clerk was rude to her because he was rude to everyone. He did not matter any more than the others. The wino tried to catch her by the arm as she left. "Come on. You not in too big a hurry to talk to me." She almost ran from him, barely controlling her disgust. She left him standing, swaying slightly in the middle of the street, staring after her. As she neared the hotel, she noticed someone standing in the narrow doorway, a man who had something wrong with his face. Something. She almost turned and went back toward the drunk. But the man stepped out and came over to her during her moment of hesitation. She looked around quickly, her eyes wide with fear. No one was paying any particular attention to her. Even the wino had begun to move away. The man said, "I don't go away if you ignore me." He had a scar that ran the length of his face from eye to chin on the left side. When he talked or smiled or frowned, it moved, and she could watch it and ignore everything else. Sometimes she could even avoid listening to him. Now she watched it and thought quickly. "So you got out." There was nothing but bitterness in her voice. He laughed and the scar curved, worm-like. "This morning, I expected you to be there to meet me." "No, you didn't. I told you 3 months ago you could stay locked up forever as far as I was concerned." "And you didn't mean it then either. 90 days. That's a long time." "You should have thought about that before you got into the fight." "Yeah. Man hits me and pulls a knife. I had all the time in the world to remember you didn't want me fighting." He paused. "You know, you could have come to see me just once while I was in." "I'm sorry." Toneless. False without any attempt to hide the falseness. He made a sound of disgust. "The day you're sorry for anything." "All right, I'm not sorry. I don't give a damn." She narrowed her eyes and threw the words at him. "Why don't you go find a girl who will come to see you next time you get put away?" The scar hardly moved when he spoke. Things changed that much in 3 months. They changed that much. "You find somebody else to kind of help you forget about me?" Now she laughed once with absolute bitterness. "Not one, baby. Dozens. Didn't you see them all back there on the corner? They couldn't wait to get to me." Quietly. All right, be quiet." He put an arm around her and walked with her toward her apartment. Later, when they had eaten and made love, she sat head in hands, trying not to think while he talked at her. She paid no attention until he asked a question that she wanted to answer. "Don't you ever wish for a decent-looking guy to come and get you out of that factory and out of this dump you live in and away from me?" "What would a decent-looking guy want with me?" Instead of answering, he said, "You still have that bottle of sleeping pills in your medicine cabinet?" When she did not answer, he went to look. "Non-prescription now," he said when he came back. "What happened to the others?" "I poured them down the toilet." "Why?" Again, she did not answer. After a moment, he said more gently, "When?" When they put you in jail." "And you acted like you didn't expect to see me again." She shook her head. "I didn't." "I don't want to die any more than you do." She jumped and glanced at him. He knew better than to talk like that. He did it to hurt her. That was all. She said, "I'd rather be dead than here picking up where we left off 3 months ago." "Then why'd you throw out the pills?" "So I would live without you." He smiled. "And when did you decide you couldn't?" She threw the heavy glass ashtray beside the bed. It flew wide of him, dented the wall behind him, and broke into 3 pieces. He looked from the pieces to her. "You would have made your point better if you had tried to hit me." She began to cry, and she was not aware when the crying became screaming. "Get out of here! Leave me alone! Leave me alone!" He didn't move. Then her neighbor was pounding on the door to find out what all the noise was about. She calmed herself enough to open it, but while she was reassuring the woman that everything was all right, he came up behind her and stood there. She did not have to look around to know he was there. Still, she did not come near losing control until her neighbor said, "You must be lonesome over here by yourself. Why don't you come around to my apartment and talk for a while?" It was as though her neighbor were playing a stupid, childish joke on her. It should have been a joke. Somehow, she got rid of the woman without breaking down. Then she turned and stared at the man, at the scar marring a face that had never been handsome. She shook her head, crying again, but paying no attention to her tears. He seemed to know better than to touch her. After a while, she got her coat and started out the door. "I'm going with you." The look she gave him contained all the stored-up viciousness of the day. "Do whatever you want. She saw fear in his eyes for the first time. Where are you going? She said, you didn't have to meet me on the street today or come to the door just now. You didn't have to talk about Jane. Where are you going? There were few things she hated more than her own name. In all the time they had been together, he could not have used it more than twice. She slammed the door in his face. What am I that I could need you anyway? She wished she had said the words to him, but it didn't matter. It was just another of the things she didn't have the courage to do, like accepting the loneliness, or dying, or... She retraced her steps back to the liquor store. The boys had gone, but the wino was still there, leaning against a telephone pole, and holding a bag shaped by the bottle inside it.
So you come back, huh?
He couldn't stand at a distance and talk. He had to put his face right up next to hers. It was an act of will for her not to vomit. He thrust the bag at her.
You can have a little bit if you want. I got some more in my room.
She stared at the bottle for a moment, then almost snatched it from him. She drank without giving herself time to taste or think or gag. She had lived around drunks most of her life. She knew that if she could get enough down, nothing would matter. She let the wino guide her toward the hotel. There was a scar-faced man coming toward them from down the block. She sucked another swallow from the bottle and waited for him to vanish. Afterward. In the terrible little jobs that I used to get at factories, warehouses, food processing plants, offices, and retail outlets, there always seemed to be at least one or two very odd people. Everyone knew about them. Sometimes they were actually on medication, sometimes not. But with or without medication, they had serious, noticeable problems. I lived in terror of joining them. Those grindingly dull jobs, I thought, were capable of sending anyone up the wall. I suspect most of my coworkers thought I was already pretty strange. I spent my breaks writing, or I was tired and cranky from getting up early in the morning to write at home. Crossover not only grew out of that time, but was written during that time. It was written during the summer of 1970 at Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Workshop. When I went to Clarion, I hadn't sold any of my stories. Then Robin Scott Wilson, at the time director of Clarion, bought Crossover, and Harlan Ellison bought another of my stories. I was overjoyed. I thought I was on my way as a writer. No more failure and scut work. In fact, I had 5 more years of rejection slips and horrible little jobs ahead of me before I sold another word. I didn't wind up hallucinating or turning to alcohol, as the character in Crossover does, but I did keep noticing the company oddities everywhere I worked, and they went right on scaring me back to the typewriter whenever I strayed. Two essays. Positive Obsession. My mother read me bedtime stories until I was 6 years old. It was a sneak attack on her part. As soon as I really got to like the stories, she said, "Here's the book, now you read." She didn't know what she was setting us both up for. Two. "I think," my mother said to me one day when I was 10, "that everyone has something that they can do better than they can do anything else. It's up to them to find out what that something is." We were in the kitchen by the stove. She was pressing my hair while I sat bent over someone's cast-off notebook, writing. I had decided to write down some of the stories I'd been telling myself over the years. When I didn't have stories to read, I learned to make them up. Now I was learning to write them down. Three. I was shy, afraid of most people, most situations. I didn't stop to ask myself how things could hurt me or even whether they could hurt me. I was just afraid. I crept into my first bookstore full of vague fears. I had managed to save about $5, mostly in change. It was 1957. $5 was a lot of money for a 10-year-old. The public library had been my second home since I was 6, and I owned a number of hand-me-down books. But now, I wanted a new book, one I had chosen, one I could keep. "Can kids come in here?" I asked the woman at the cash register once I was inside. I meant, could black kids come in? My mother, born in rural Louisiana and raised amid strict racial segregation, had warned me that I might not be welcome everywhere, even in California. The cashier glanced at me. "Of course you can come in," she said. Then, as though it were an afterthought, she smiled. I relaxed. The first book I bought described the characteristics of different breeds of horses. The second described stars and planets, asteroids, moons, and comets. 4. My aunt and I were in her kitchen, talking. She was cooking something that smelled good, and I was sitting at her table, watching. Luxury. At home, my mother would have had me helping. "I want to be a writer when I grow up," I said. "Do you?" my aunt asked. "Well, that's nice, but you'll have to get a job, too." "Writing will be my job," I said. "You can write any time. It's a nice hobby, but you'll have to earn a living." "As a writer?" "Don't be silly." "I mean it. Honey, Negroes can't be writers." "Why not?" "They just can't." "Yes, they can, too." I was most adamant when I didn't know what I was talking about. In all my 13 years, I had never read a printed word that I knew to have been written by a black person. My aunt was a grown woman. She knew more than I did. What if she were right? 5. Shyness is shit. It isn't cute or feminine or appealing. It's torment and it's shit. I spent a lot of my childhood and adolescence staring at the ground. It's a wonder I didn't become a geologist. I whispered. People were always saying, "Speak up, we can't hear you." I memorized required reports and poems for school, then cried my way out of having to recite. Some teachers condemned me for not studying. Some forgave me for not being very bright. Only a few saw my shyness. "She's so backward," some of my relatives said. "She's so nice and quiet," tactful friends of my mother said. I believed I was ugly and stupid, clumsy, and socially hopeless. I also thought that everyone would notice these faults if I drew attention to myself. I wanted to disappear. Instead, I grew to be 6 feet tall. Boys in particular seemed to assume that I had done this growing deliberately and that I should be ridiculed for it as often as possible. I hid out in a big pink notebook, one that would hold a whole ream of paper. I made myself a universe in it. There I could be a magic horse, a Martian, a telepath. There I could be anywhere but here, any time but now, with any people but these. 6. My mother did day work. She had a habit of bringing home any books her employers threw out. She had been permitted only 3 years of school. Then she had been put to work. Oldest daughter. She believed passionately in books and education. She wanted me to have what she had been denied. She wasn't sure which books I might be able to use, so she brought whatever she found in the trash. I had books yellow with age, books without covers, books written in, crayoned in, spilled on, cut, torn, even partly burned. I stacked them in wooden crates and second-hand bookcases and read them when I was ready for them. Some were years too advanced for me when I got them, but I grew into them. 7. An obsession, according to my old Random House dictionary, is the domination of one's thoughts or feelings by a persistent idea, image, desire, etc. Obsession can be a useful tool if it's a positive obsession. Using it is like aiming carefully in archery. I took archery in high school because it wasn't a team sport. I liked some of the team sports, but in archery, you did well or badly according to your own efforts. No one else to blame. I wanted to see what I could do. I learned to aim high. Aim above the target, Aim just there. Relax. Let go. If you aimed right, you hit the bullseye. I saw positive obsession as a way of aiming yourself, your life, at your chosen target. Decide what you want. Aim high. Go for it. I wanted to sell a story. Before I knew how to type, I wanted to sell a story. I pecked my stories out, two-fingered on the Remington portable typewriter my mother had bought me. I had begged for it when I was 10, and she had bought it.
"You'll spoil that child," one of her friends told her. "What does she need with a typewriter at her age? It will soon be sitting in the closet with dust on it. All that money wasted."
I asked my science teacher, Mr. Pfaff, to type one of my stories for me. Type it the way it was supposed to be, with no holes erased into the paper and no strikeovers. He did. He even corrected my terrible spelling and punctuation. To this day, I'm amazed and grateful. 8. I had no idea how to submit a story for publication. I blundered through unhelpful library books on writing. Then I found a discarded copy of The Writer, a magazine I had never heard of. That copy sent me back to the library to look for more, and for other writers' magazines to see what I could learn from them. In very little time, I'd found out how to submit a story, and my story was in the mail. A few weeks later, I got my first rejection slip. When I was older, I decided that getting a rejection slip was like being told your child was ugly. You got mad and didn't believe a word of it. Besides, look at all the really ugly literary children out there in the world being published and doing fine. 9. I spent my teens and much of my 20s collecting printed rejections. Early on, my mother lost $61.20, a reading fee charged by a so-called agent to look at one of my unpublishable stories. No one had told us that agents weren't supposed to get any money up front, weren't supposed to be paid until they sold your work. Then they were to take 10% of whatever the work earned. Ignorance is expensive. That $61.20 was more money back then than my mother paid for a month's rent. 10. I badgered friends and acquaintances into reading my work, and they seemed to like it. Teachers read it and said kindly, unhelpful things. But there were no creative writing classes at my high school and no useful criticism. At college, in California at that time, junior college was almost free, I took classes taught by an elderly woman who wrote children's stories. She was polite about the science fiction and fantasy that I kept handing in, but she finally asked in exasperation, "Can't you write anything normal?" 11. A school-wide contest was held. All submissions had to be made anonymously. My short story won first prize. I was an 18-year-old freshman, and I won in spite of competition from older, more experienced people. Beautiful. The $15 prize was the first money my writing earned me. After college, I did office work for a while, then factory and warehouse work. My size and strength were advantages in factories and warehouses, and no one expected me to smile and pretend I was having a good time. I got up at 2 or 3 in the morning and wrote. Then I went to work. I hated it, and I have no gift for suffering in silence. I muttered and complained and quit jobs and found new ones and collected more rejection slips. One day in disgust, I threw them all away. Why keep such useless, painful things? 12. There seems to be an unwritten rule, hurtful and at odds with the realities of American culture. It says you aren't supposed to wonder whether, as a black person, a black woman, you really might be inferior. Not quite bright enough. Not quite quick enough. Not quite good enough to do the things you want to do. Though, of course, you do wonder. You're supposed to know you're as good as anyone. And if you don't know, you aren't supposed to admit it. If anyone near you admits it, you're supposed to reassure them quickly so they'll shut up. That sort of talk is embarrassing. Act tough and confident, and don't talk about your doubts. If you never deal with them, you may never get rid of them, but no matter. Fake everyone out, even yourself. I couldn't fake myself out. I didn't talk much about my doubts. I wasn't fishing for hasty reassurances, but I did a lot of thinking, the same things over and over. Who was I, anyway? Why should anyone pay attention to what I had to say? Did I have anything to say? I was writing science fiction and fantasy, for God's sake. At that time, nearly all professional science fiction writers were white men. As much as I loved science fiction and fantasy, what was I doing? Well, whatever it was, I couldn't stop. Positive obsession is about not being able to stop just because you're afraid and full of doubts. Positive obsession is dangerous. It's about not being able to stop at all. 13. I was 23 when, finally, I sold my first two short stories. I sold both to writer-editors who were teaching at Clarion, a science fiction writer's workshop that I was attending. One story was eventually published. The other wasn't. I didn't sell another word for 5 years. Then finally, I sold my first novel. Thank God no one told me selling would take so long. Not that I would have believed it. I've sold 8 novels since then. Last Christmas, I paid off the mortgage on my mother's house. 14. So, then, I write science fiction and fantasy for a living. As far as I know, I'm still the only black woman who does this. When I began to do a little public speaking, one of the questions I heard most often was, "What good is science fiction to black people?" I was usually asked this by a black person. I gave bits and pieces of answers that didn't satisfy me and that probably didn't satisfy my questioners. I resented the question. Why should I have to justify my profession to anyone? But the answer to that was obvious. There was exactly one other black science fiction writer working successfully when I sold my first novel, Samuel R. Delaney, Jr. Now there are 4 of us, Delaney, Stephen Barnes, Charles R. Saunders, and me. So few. Why? Lack of interest? Lack of confidence? A young black woman once said to me, "I always wanted to write science fiction, but I didn't think there were any black women doing it." Doubts show themselves in all sorts of ways. But still, I'm asked, what good is science fiction to black people? What good is any form of literature to black people? What good is science fiction's thinking about the present, the future, and the past? What good is its tendency to warn or to consider alternative ways of thinking and doing? What good is its examination of the possible effects of science and technology or social organization and political direction? At its best, science fiction stimulates imagination and creativity. It gets reader and writer off the beaten track, off the narrow, narrow footpath of what everyone is saying, doing, thinking, whoever everyone happens to be this year. And what good is all this to black people? Afterward. This autobiographical article appeared originally in Essence magazine under the Essence title, Birth of a Writer. I never liked the Essence title. My title was always Positive Obsession. I've often said that since my life was filled with reading, writing, and not much else, it was too dull to write about. I still feel that way. I'm glad I wrote this piece, but I didn't enjoy writing it. I have no doubt at all that the best and the most interesting part of me is my fiction. Furor Scribendi. Writing for publication may be both the easiest and the hardest thing you'll ever do. Learning the rules, if they can be called rules, is the easy part. Following them, Turning them into regular habits is an ongoing struggle. Here are the rules. 1. Read. Read about the art, the craft, and the business of writing. Read the kind of work you'd like to write. Read good literature and bad, fiction and fact. Read every day and learn from what you read. If you commute to work, or if you spend part of your day doing relatively mindless work, listen to book tapes. If your library doesn't have a good supply of complete books on audio tape, companies like Recorded Books, Books on Tape, Brilliance Corporation, and The Literate Ear will rent or sell you a wide selection of such books for your pleasure and continuing education. These provide a painless way to ponder use of language, the sounds of words, conflict, characterization, plotting, and the multitudes of ideas you can find in history, biography, medicine, the sciences, etc. 2. Take classes and go to writer's workshops. Writing is communication. You need other people to let you know whether you're communicating what you think you are and whether you're doing it in ways that are not only accessible and entertaining, but as compelling as you can make them. In other words, you need to know that you're telling a good story. You want to be the writer who keeps readers up late at night, not the one who drives them off to watch television. Workshops and classes are rented readers, rented audiences for your work. Learn from the comments, questions, and suggestions of both the teacher and the class. These relative strangers are more likely to tell you the truth about your work than are your friends and family who may not want to hurt or offend you. One tiresome truth they might tell you, for instance, is that you need to take a grammar class. If they say this, listen. Take the class. Vocabulary and grammar are your primary tools. They're most effectively used, even most effectively abused, by people who understand them. No computer program, no friend, or employee can take the place of a sound knowledge of your tools. 3. Write. Write every day. Write whether you feel like writing or not. Choose a time of day. Perhaps you can get up an hour earlier, stay up an hour later, give up an hour of recreation, or even give up your lunch hour. If you can't think of anything in your chosen genre, keep a journal. You should be keeping one anyway. Journal writing helps you to be more observant of your world, and a journal is a good place to store story ideas for later projects. 4. Revise your writing until it's as good as you can make it. All the reading, the writing, and the classes should help you do this. Check your writing, your research, never neglect your research, and the physical appearance of your manuscript. Let nothing substandard slip through. If you notice something that needs fixing, fix it. No excuses. There will be plenty that's wrong that you won't catch. Don't make the mistake of ignoring flaws that are obvious to you. The moment you find yourself saying, "This doesn't matter, it's good enough," stop, go back, fix the flaw. Make a habit of doing your best. 5. Submit your work for publication. First, research the markets that interest you. Seek out and study the books or magazines of publishers to whom you want to sell. Then, submit your work. If the idea of doing this scares you, fine. Go ahead and be afraid, but send your work out anyway. If it's rejected, send it out again and again. Rejections are painful, but inevitable. They're every writer's rite of passage. Don't give up on a piece of work that you can't sell. You may be able to sell it later to new publications or to new editors of old publications. At worst, you should be able to learn from your rejected work. You may even be able to use all or part of it in a new work. One way or another, writers can use, or at least learn from, everything. 6. Here are some potential impediments for you to forget about. First, forget inspiration. Habit is more dependable. Habit will sustain you whether you're inspired or not. Habit will help you finish and polish your stories. Inspiration won't. Habit is persistence in practice. Forget talent. If you have it, fine, use it. If you don't have it, it doesn't matter. As habit is more dependable than inspiration, continued learning is more dependable than talent. Never let pride or laziness prevent you from learning, improving your work, changing its direction when necessary. Persistence is essential to any writer. The persistence to finish your work, to keep writing in spite of rejection, to keep reading, studying, submitting work for sale. But stubbornness, the refusal to change unproductive behavior or to revise unsaleable work, can be lethal to your writing hopes. Finally, don't worry about imagination. You have all the imagination you need, and all the reading, journal writing, and learning you will be doing will stimulate it. Play with your ideas. Have fun with them. Don't worry about being silly or outrageous or wrong. So much of writing is fun. It's first letting your interests and your imagination take you anywhere at all. Once you're able to do that, you'll have more ideas than you can use. Then the real work of fashioning them into a story begins. Stay with it. Persist. Afterword. I wrote this brief essay for the Writers of the Future anthology series. L. Ron Hubbard presents Writers of the Future 9. This series showcases the work of new writers, and my essay is a compact version of a talk that I've given to groups of new writers. The last word of the essay is its most important word. Writing is difficult. You do it all alone, without encouragement, and without any certainty that you'll ever be published or paid, or even that you'll be able to finish that particular work you've begun. It isn't easy to persist amid all that. That's why I've called this mild little essay Furor Scribendi, a rage for writing. Rage, positive obsession, burning need to write. Call it anything you like. It's a useful emotion. Sometimes when I'm interviewed, the interviewer either compliments me on my talent, my gift, or asks me how I discovered it. I don't know. Maybe it was supposed to be lying in my closet or on the street somewhere, waiting to be discovered. I used to struggle to answer this politely, to explain that I didn't believe much in writing talent. People who want to write either do it or they don't. At last, I began to say that my most important talent or habit was persistence. Without it, I would have given up writing long before I finished my first novel. It's amazing what we can do if we simply refuse to give up. I suspect that this is the most important thing I've said in all my interviews and talks, as well as in this book. It's a truth that applies to more than writing. It applies to anything that is important, but difficult, important, but frightening. We're all capable of climbing so much higher than we usually permit ourselves to suppose. The word again is persist. News stories. Amnesty. The stranger community, globular, easily 12 feet high and wide, glided down into the vast, dimly lit food production hall of translator Noah Cannon's employer. The stranger was incongruously quick and graceful, keeping to the paths, never once brushing against the raised beds of fragile edible fungi. It looked, Noah thought, a little like a great black moss-enshrouded bush with such a canopy of irregularly shaped leaves, shaggy mosses, and twisted vines that no light showed through it. It had a few thick, naked branches growing out, away from the main body, breaking the symmetry, and making the community look in serious need of pruning. The moment Noah saw it, and saw her employer, a somewhat smaller, better maintained-looking dense black bush, back away from her, she knew she would be offered the new job assignment she had been asking for. The stranger community settled, flattening itself at bottom, allowing its organisms of mobility to migrate upward and take their rest. The stranger community focused its attention on Noah, electricity flaring and zigzagging, making a visible display within the dark vastness of its body. She knew that the electrical display was speech, although she could not read what was said. The communities spoke in this way between themselves and within themselves, but the light they produced moved far too quickly for her to even begin to learn the language. The fact that she saw the display, though, meant that the communications entities of the stranger community were addressing her. Communities used their momentarily inactive organisms to shield communication from anyone outside themselves who was not being addressed. She glanced at her employer and saw that its attention was focused away from her. It had no noticeable eyes, but its entities of vision served it very well whether she could see them or not. It had drawn itself together, made itself look more like a spiny stone than a bush. Communities did this when they wished to offer others privacy or simply disassociate themselves from the business being transacted. Her employer had warned her that the job that would be offered to her would be unpleasant, not only because of the usual hostility of the human beings she would face, but because the subcontractor for whom she would be working would be difficult. The subcontractor had had little contact with human beings. Its vocabulary in the painfully created common language that enabled humans and the communities to speak to one another was, at best, rudimentary, as was its understanding of human abilities and limitations. Translation, by accident or by intent, the subcontractor would probably hurt her. Her employer had told her that she did not have to take this job, that it would support her if she chose not to work for this subcontractor. It did not altogether approve of her decision to try for the job anyway. Now its deliberate inattention had more to do with disassociation than with courtesy or privacy. "You're on your own," its posture said, and she smiled. She could never have worked for it if it had not been able to stand aside and let her make her own decisions. Yet it did not go about its business and leave her alone with the stranger. It waited. And here was the subcontractor signaling her with lightning. Obediently, she went to it, stood close to it so that the tips of what looked like moss-covered outer twigs and branches touched her bare skin. She wore only shorts and a halter top. The communities would have preferred her to be naked, and for the long years of her captivity, she had had no choice. She had been naked. Now she was no longer a captive, and she insisted on wearing at least the basics. Her employer had come to accept this, and now refused to lend her to subcontractors who would refuse her the right to wear clothing. This subcontractor enfolded her immediately, drawing her upward and in among its many selves, first hauling her up with its various organisms of manipulation, then grasping her securely with what appeared to be moss. The communities were not plants, but it was easiest to think of them in those terms, since most of the time, most of them looked so plant-like. Enfolded within the community, she couldn't see at all. She closed her eyes to avoid the distraction of trying to see or imagining that she saw. She felt herself surrounded by what felt like long, dry fibers, fronds, rounded fruits of various sizes, and other things that produced less identifiable sensations. She was at once touched, stroked, massaged, compressed in the strangely comfortable, peaceful way that she had come to look forward to whenever she was employed. She was turned and handled as though she weighed nothing. In fact, after a few moments, she felt weightless. She had lost all sense of direction, yet she felt totally secure, clasped by entities that had nothing resembling human limbs. Why this was pleasurable, she never understood. But for 12 years of captivity, it had been her only dependable comfort. It had happened often enough to enable her to endure everything else that was done to her. Fortunately, the communities also found it comforting, even more than she did. After a while, she felt the particular rhythm of quick warning pressures across her back. The communities liked the broad expanse of skin that the human back offered. She made a beckoning motion with her right hand to let the community know that she was paying attention. There are 6 recruits. It signaled with pressures against her back. You will teach them.
I will, she signed, using her hands and arms only. The communities liked her signs to be small, confined gestures when she was enfolded, and large, sweeping hand, arm, and whole body efforts when she was outside and not being touched. She had wondered at first if this was because they couldn't see very well. Now she knew that they could see far better than she could see over great distances with specialized entities of vision, could see most bacteria and some viruses, and see colors from ultraviolet through infrared. In fact, the reason that they preferred large gestures when she was out of contact and unlikely to hit or kick anyone was because they liked to watch her move. It was that simple, that odd. In fact, the communities had developed a real liking for human dance performances and for some human sports events, especially individual performances in gymnastics and ice skating.
The recruits are disturbed, the subcontractor said. They may be dangerous to one another. Calm them.
I will try, Noah said. I will answer their questions and reassure them that they have nothing to fear. Privately, she suspected that hate might be a more prevalent emotion than fear, but if the subcontractor didn't know that, she wouldn't tell it.
Calm them, the subcontractor repeated, and she knew then that it meant, literally, change them from disturbed people to calm, willing workers. The communities could change one another just by exchanging a few of their individual entities, as long as both exchanging communities were willing. Too many of them assumed that human beings should be able to do something like this, too, and that if they wouldn't, they were just being stubborn. Noah repeated, I will answer their questions and reassure them that they have nothing to fear. That's all I can do.
Will they be calm?
She drew a deep breath, knowing that she was about to be hurt, twisted or torn, broken or stunned. Many communities punished refusal to obey orders, as they saw it, less harshly than they punished what they saw as lying. In fact, the punishments were left over from the years when human beings were captives of uncertain ability, intellect, and perception. People were not supposed to be punished any longer, but of course they were. Now, Noah thought, it was best to get whatever punishment there might be out of the way at once. She could not escape. She signed stolidly. Some of them may believe what I tell them and be calm. Others will need time and experience to calm them. She was at once held more tightly, almost painfully, held hard, as the communities called it, held so that she could not move even her arms, could not harm any members of the community by thrashing about in pain. Just before she might have been injured by the squeezing alone, it stopped. She was hit with a sudden electrical shock that convulsed her. It drove the breath out of her in a hoarse scream. It made her see flashes of light, even with her eyes tightly closed. It stimulated her muscles into abrupt, agonizing contortions. Calm them, the community insisted once again. She could not answer at first. It took her a moment to get her now sore and shaking body under control and to understand what was being said to her. It took her a moment more to be able to flex her hands and arms, now free again, and finally to shape an answer, the only possible answer, in spite of what it might cost. I will answer their questions and reassure them that they have nothing to fear. She was held hard for several seconds more and knew that she might be given another shock. After a while, though, there were several flashes of light that she saw out of the corner of her eye, but that did not seem to have anything to do with her. Then, without any more communication, Noah was passed into the care of her employer, and the subcontractor was gone. She saw nothing as she was passed from darkness to darkness. There was nothing to hear but the usual rustle of communities moving about. There was no change of scent, or if there was, her nose was not sensitive enough to detect it. Yet somehow, She had learned to know her employer's touch. She relaxed in relief. "Are you injured?" her employer signed. "No," she answered. "Just aching joints and other sore places." "Did I get the job?" "Of course you did. You must tell me if that subcontractor tries to coerce you again. It knows better. I've told it that if it injures you, I will never allow you to work for it again." "Thank you." There was a moment of stillness. Then the employer stroked her, calming her and pleasing itself. "You insist on taking these jobs, but you can't use them to make the changes you want to make. You know that. You cannot change your people or mine." "I can, a little," she signed. "Community by community, human by human. I would work faster if I could." "And so you let subcontractors abuse you. You try to help your own people to see new possibilities and understand changes that have already happened, but most of them won't listen, and they hate you." "I want to make them think. I want to tell them what human governments won't tell them. I want to vote for peace between your people and mine by telling the truth. I don't know whether my efforts will do any good in the long run, but I have to try." "Let yourself heal. Rest enfolded until the subcontractor returns for you." Noah sighed, content, within another moment of stillness. "Thank you for helping me, even though you don't believe." "I would like to believe, but you can't succeed. Right now, groups of your own people are looking for ways to destroy us." Noah winced. "I know. Can you stop them without killing them?" Her employer shifted her, stroked her. "Probably not," it signed. "Not again." Translator Michelle Ota began as the applicants trailed into the meeting room. "Do these things actually understand that we're intelligent?" She followed Noah into the meeting room, waited to see where Noah would sit, and sat next to her. Noah noticed that Michelle Ota was one of only two of the six applicants who was willing to sit near her, even for this informal question and answer session. Noah had information that they needed. She was doing a job some of them might wind up doing someday, and yet that job, translator and personnel officer for the communities, and the fact that she could do it was their reason for distrusting her. The second person who wanted to sit near her was Sorrel Trent. She was interested in alien spirituality, whatever that might be. The four remaining job candidates chose to leave empty seats between themselves and Noah. "Of course, the communities know we're intelligent," Noah said. "I mean, I know you work for them." Michelle Ota glanced at her, hesitated, then went on. "I want to work for them too, because at least they're hiring. Almost nobody else is. But what do they think of us?" "They'll be offering some of you contracts soon," Noah said. "They wouldn't waste time doing that if they'd mistaken you for cattle." She relaxed back into her chair, watching some of the six other people in the room get water, fruit, or nuts from the sideboards. The food was good and clean and free to them whether or not they were hired. It was also, she knew, the first food most of them had had that day. Food was expensive, and in these depressed times, most people were lucky to eat once a day. It pleased her to see them enjoying it. She was the one who had insisted there be food in the meeting rooms for the question and answer sessions. She herself was enjoying the rare comfort of wearing shoes, long black cotton pants, and a colorful, flowing tunic. And there was furniture designed for the human body, an upholstered armchair with a high back and a table she could eat from or rest her arms on. She had no such furniture in her quarters within the Mojave bubble. She suspected that she could have at least the furniture now if she asked her employer for it. But she had not asked, would not ask. Human things were for human places. "But what does a contract mean to things that come from another star system?" Michelle Ota demanded. Rune Johnson spoke up. "Yes, it's interesting how quickly these beings have taken up local terrestrial ways when it suits them. Translator, do you truly believe they will consider themselves bound by anything they sign? although without hands, God knows how they managed to sign anything. They will consider both themselves and you bound by it if both they and you sign it, Noah said. And yes, they can make highly individual marks that serve as signatures. They spend a great deal of their time and wealth in this country with translators, lawyers, and politicians, working things out so that each community was counted as a legal person whose individual mark would be accepted. And for 20 years since then, they've honored their contracts. Rune Johnson shook his blonde head. In all, they've been on Earth longer than I've been alive. And yet it feels wrong that they're here. It feels wrong that they exist. I don't even hate them, and it still feels wrong. I suppose that's because we've been displaced again from the center of the universe. We human beings, I mean. Down through the history, in myth and even in science, we've kept putting ourselves in the center and then being evicted. Noah smiled, surprised and pleased. I noticed the same thing. Now we find ourselves in a kind of sibling rivalry with the communities. There is other intelligent life. The universe has other children. We knew it, but until they arrived here, we could pretend otherwise.
That's crap, another woman said.
Thera Collier, her name was, a big, angry, red-haired young woman. The weeds came here, uninvited, stole our land, and kidnapped our people. She had been eating an apple. She slammed it down hard on the table, crushing what was left of it, spattering juice. That's what we need to remember. That's what we need to do something about. Do what? Another woman asked. We're here to get jobs, not fight. Noah searched her memory from the new speaker's name and found it. Piedad Ruiz, a small brown woman who spoke English clearly but with a strong Spanish accent. She looked, with her bruised face and arms, as though she had taken a fairly serious beating recently. But when Noah had asked her about it before the group came into the meeting room, she held her head up and said she was fine and it was nothing. Probably someone had not wanted her to apply for work at the bubble. Considering the rumors that were sometimes spread about the communities and why they hired human beings, that was not surprising. What have aliens told you about their coming, translator? Rune Johnson asked. He was, Noah remembered from her reading of the short biography that had been given to her with his job application, the son of a small businessman whose clothing store had not survived the depression brought about by the arrival of the communities. He wanted to look after his parents, and he wanted to get married. Ironically, the answer to both those problems seemed to be to go to work for the communities for a while. You are old enough to remember the things they did when they arrived, he said. What did they tell you about why they abducted people, killed people? They abducted me, Noah admitted. That silenced the room for several seconds. Each of the six potential recruits stared at her, perhaps wondering or pitying, judging or worrying, perhaps even recoiling in horror, suspicion, or disgust. She had received all these reactions from recruits and from others who knew her history, people who had never been able to be neutral about abductees. Noah tended to use her history as a way to start questions, accusations, and perhaps thought. Noah Cannon, Rune Johnson said, proving that he had at least been listening when she introduced herself. I thought that name sounded familiar. You were part of the second wave of abductions. I remember seeing your name on the list of abductees. I noticed it because you were listed as female. I had never run across a woman named Noah before. So they kidnapped you and now you work for them? This was James Hunter Adio, a tall, lean, angry-looking young black man. Noah was black herself, and yet James Adio had apparently decided the moment they met that he didn't like her. Now he looked not only angry, but disgusted. I was 11 when I was taken, Noah said. She looked at Rune Johnson. You're right. I was part of the second wave. So what? Then they experimented on you? James Adio asked. Noah met his gaze. They did, yes. The people of the first wave suffered the most. The communities didn't know anything about us. They killed some of us with experiments and dietary deficiency diseases, and they poisoned others. By the time they snatched me, they at least knew enough not to kill me by accident.